Hello everyone, this is Matthew, the lead pastor at Cedar Ridge. Welcome to our virtual worship service today. Thank you so much for joining us. These are unusual times, obviously, with the coronavirus pandemic. We've had to close our church buildings, but we're still very much alive and well as a church, and we are gathering together like this online to continue the sort of things that we normally do on a Sunday morning. And we'll also be carrying on with our various programs. We'll adapt those accordingly, obviously, but we're in particular looking out for people in our own community and the community around us who are feeling very vulnerable at this moment in time. And we'll be sending out updates in the coming weeks about activities that are going on to love and support and care for people around us, even with all the social distancing that is necessary in these circumstances. We're especially focused actually on the Greencastle Elementary School that we support, because with schools closing, as I'm sure you realize, many children will have less access to food. So we're really checking on that situation, offering as much support as we can. So we'll keep you updated on that, but things are moving forward. So we are really happy that we can gather like this online. It's a little bit different, but these are special circumstances. So thank you so much for joining us this morning. Not going to say too much about coronavirus. You've hopefully seen the emails that have gone out. Do check those if you haven't. And as I said, we'll keep updating you as things progress. We're in a series at the moment called Inside Out and Upside Down. It's looking at Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, this famous passage in chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Matthew's Gospel. And this is week 3. It's the third Sunday of Lent. And we're going to look at a passage which is sometimes referred to as the antitheses. In fact, you'll have probably heard that read already. I'd strongly recommend that you listen to the reading before this message, or just have a copy of that passage with you as we go through this. The antitheses are called that because Jesus in this passage seems to be turning the law upside down. He seems to be reinterpreting things, and he uses this phrase, "You have heard it said, dot, 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 but I say." And he has 6 issues that he addressed. Let's just sort of summarize those right at the beginning here. He talks about murder, but what he's really talking about is unhealthy, violent anger. What Jesus does with these antitheses, with each item of the law that he addresses, he seems to get to the root of the problem, and he goes to the inside, and he's not so worried about just outside behavior. That's not unimportant. Let's state that categorically. But Jesus sees that the root of the issues begin on the inside, so he's always going to the inside. So the first one, murder, is associated with the issue of internal unhealthy anger. Adultery, which really seems to be related in Jesus's mind to an unhealthy desire or lust that starts on the inside, starts from what he would describe as our heart. He talks about divorce, and the issue there seems to be one of justice, where people back in Jesus's day and before that time, in the Hebrew tradition, a male could just get a certificate of divorce, divorce his wife, and she would be left destitute. So there's a justice issue that's at stake here. He talks about oaths, which seems to be related to just telling the truth, not calling on a third party or on another source to verify your truth or to swear oaths, but rather just let your yes be yes and your no be no. He talks about revenge. This is the famous passage about an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And he says that we should forgive. And he talks about loving non-violence as a response to when we are inappropriately treated. The issue there is, again, one coming out from the inside. And then finally, he touches on the issue of hatred. He says, you've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies. And so he's getting there to the root of unforgiveness, bitterness, a lack of acceptance that is part of the human condition that's in the human heart. So there's those 6 antitheses, as they're called. Don't think that's necessarily an exhaustive list. It's certainly I would say of myself, I'm vulnerable to every single one of those, but there's a whole load more things about life that I'm vulnerable to as well. So I don't think this is necessarily an exhaustive list, but it's a list that's given to us to illustrate, it seems, something that's at the heart of Jesus's teaching. So we're not going to dig too deep into any one of those. I wanted to point you actually to the material that we have for the series this week. For this whole series. But this week's material has some questions about each of these six antitheses. You could look at one or two of them, or look at all of them. Some questions that apply to all. So do check out the material. Do the discussion questions, and there's also a reflection and a meditation exercise based on stillness, which is one of our themes for this series, that you can do as well, which will help us get to the root of our problems, get to the inside, as we do that. And that's connected to some of the meditations we've been doing in the previous weeks too. What I wanted to do today is just take a little look at some contextual issues for the passage, just raise some points that I think might then help us as we all then reread it, look at it more deeply, do the discussion questions. It might help us with our interpretation and application to our own lives. I don't know about you, but when I hear this passage read first, you know, just listening to it, a few troubling things jump out. So we're just going to touch on one or two of those and some other issues too. And then we'll sort of try to back away and say, okay, what is Jesus really getting at here in all six of these antitheses? Okay, so let's just start off with looking at one of the opening lines here. In fact, the very first verse of this section, it begins in verse 15 of chapter 5. It says, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." So here we have Jesus talking about the law. And that's kind of an alien term to us, really, or it's an alien notion to us. I mean, we're familiar with it being talked about perhaps at church and in our, when we read the Bible. But we're not really a culture that lives by a religious law. Obviously, the ancient Hebrews did live that way. And the law was not just a bunch of rules or regulations related to religion. It was about a whole way of life. And Moses brought the law, what the Hebrews called the Torah. And, you know, we know, for instance, some of the Ten Commandments, I'm sure. Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Jesus touches on those two in this passage. But there were so many other laws that applied to pretty much every aspect of life. So this is really a way of life issue. It's not just about a few religious practices, a few religious rules and regulations. And as we've said, Jesus in Matthew's gospel is really presented to us as a new Moses, somebody who's bringing perhaps a new law or a reinterpretation of the law or a new way of life. And that way of life, Jesus calls it the kingdom of heaven, this divine life, this heavenly life. And he says that's available and present to us right here and now. So what Jesus seems to be doing here is really addressing the problem with that had evolved with the law, or perhaps is inherent in the Hebrew law, which is it tends to cause people to behave as though God is a distant other, somebody out there who's watching us and assessing us and judging us, and someone who we have to do just enough in order to keep them happy. So the law, in Jesus's view, seems to have become this a set of boxes that you check. It's not really about the issues to do with the heart or who we are. It's more about placating a God who's out there watching us and looking at us. Jesus has a very different vision, a very different view of God. Jesus would say God is present here and now with us, within us and around us. And so in the light of the fact that God is present, it's pointless trying to hide away. It's pointless trying to hide our inside from our outside. It's almost pointless just trying to check boxes, because external behaviors, if they're not related to internal integrity, really become valueless, and in fact we'll eventually get out of control, because we just can't control our outward behavior sufficiently. without addressing the issues on the inside. So Jesus is really presenting something called the kingdom of heaven as an alternative to the law. Now, it's interesting. He's saying, I didn't come to abolish the law. He's not doing away with the Hebrew law. And, you know, scholars are sort of debate where, you know, is that really the case? Because if you look at some of these antitheses in this passage, for instance, you'll see that Jesus does actually seem to challenge the law a bit. It's not perhaps fair to say that Jesus doesn't contradict some aspects of the law at certain times. But what I think he's saying here when he's saying, I didn't come to abolish the law, is that he's saying he wants to fulfill the law. He wants to get at the real meaning of the law, what the original intent was. And so in that sense, this is about fulfillment rather than disagreement or abolishing the law. At the end of that first section there, it also says in verse 20, for I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So there's this comparison now, not just with Moses and the law, but with the Pharisees. And we're quite familiar with that, with Jesus being sort of in opposition to and in at times competition with the Pharisees. Let's also remember that when Matthew's gospel was written, probably towards the end of the first century AD or first century of the Common Era, this was a time when Judaism was in crisis. And in fact, the temple had been destroyed after the revolt against Rome. The Pharisaic mode of Judaism was in ascendancy. And that was very much at odds with the early Christian movement, which of course was initially Jewish. You know, there's no real evidence that Jesus tried to start a new religion. It was a renewal within Judaism. But over time, as the Jewish authorities felt that the Christians were not adhering to the law or not behaving as they should do or not having the correct beliefs, they were eventually pushed out of the Jewish faith and then began to form what became a new religion. But at this time when Matthew's gospel is written, that there's some competition between Christianity and Judaism. Let's just not say too much more about that, but what we do have here, I think, is evidence that Christians, followers of Jesus, are actually saying holding to the fact that we're not rejecting the law. We're not rejecting righteousness. We're not rejecting godly behavior, if you like, for want of a better term. We're not saying that isn't important. In fact, Jesus is saying, perhaps indicating that the way of the Pharisees, this external way of checking boxes, of rule following, just isn't working. And we need a new way. But that way must be efficacious. It's got to be. It's got to work. And the result of it working is greater righteousness. If you like, this way of life, this kingdom of heaven that we've talked about, will be made more fully manifest. And we touched on this issue, if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, where we talked about bearing good fruit. That the whole point of Jesus's teaching here is not necessarily just a better theology, not necessarily just a better way, but actually better fruit, better outcomes, more healthy, whole outcomes. So this issue of the law is very important to Jesus. And he goes on then at the end of this passage, sort of I've just touched on some things at the beginning, but he goes on at the end of the passage to make what I think is quite a stunning statement or a shocking statement. And there's a few of these in here. We're just going to touch on a couple of them. But right at the end, he says, be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. And, you know, that what does that mean then? Because if we're saying Jesus is getting to the heart issue and it's not just about following rules, this almost seems contradictory to that. We've got to dig a little bit into the language to get this one, I think. Because I don't think Jesus is saying you have to be faultless. Be faultless or you're going to be in big trouble. The word in the Greek there for perfect is telios. And that is a word that it's not got the connotations of perfection that we have now in the modern Western era. I think we would perhaps better describe or have labels attached to that word that would better describe it, such as wholesome, healthy. There's a sense of progression about it. It's not necessarily a state of perfection. Let's not get tripped up over that. But I think what Jesus is meaning here, and he gives us a little clue perhaps to it a few verses earlier, where he says, I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. I think what Jesus is saying is, be like God, be like your Father. He uses this beautiful metaphor for God, a father. It's a tender relational metaphor, which shows us that God is present, God is here, God is in us and around us. I think what Jesus is saying here is, children are like their parents, and we have a family image, if you like. And Jesus is saying, embody the divine image, be forgiving, love your enemies, be like God. And that's, I think, really the context in which he's saying, be perfect like God. So let's not stumble too much over that one. But again, let's note that Jesus is not watering things down. Jesus is not saying, oh, don't worry about the law or you'll be fine. Or don't worry about how you behave, you'll be fine. He's, if anything, raising the bar, I think, and saying, hey, let your righteousness, let your way of life surpass that of the Pharisees. Be perfect as God is perfect. Be forgiving and loving as God is forgiving and loving. Bear the image of your Father in heaven. So very graphic language, which should really, I think, grab our attention. Some more graphic language. So in verses 27 to 30, let me just read those. This is the famous section where Jesus talks about sexually objectifying other people. You have heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. A couple of issues here that we'll just touch on. First of all, the issue of hell. We're going to dig into the language a little bit. That term hell is actually a word for a place. It's called, the word is Gehenna. And this was a valley just outside Jerusalem. Now, the context here is interesting. The word Gehenna, in the time after Jesus, in the rabbinical tradition and in the Christian tradition, certainly became associated metaphorically with hell, as in the theological viewpoint that there's an eternal torment after death for people who have either believed the wrong things or done the wrong things. But I don't think that's what Jesus is getting at here. As I said, that thinking evolved more after Jesus. The context here for Gehenna is that in ancient times in Hebrew culture, it was a place of idolatry, a place of child sacrifice even, where kings who were not following the way of the Hebrew god Yahweh and worshipping other gods would make those sacrifices. And it had a very dark, sinister connotation to it. In Jesus's time, it was a big dump. It was where rubbish and dead animals would be thrown. And it would be constantly burning. So this sort of fiery sense to Gehenna is very literal. And I think what Jesus is getting at here is not, hey, you better watch out, because if you don't do the right thing, you're going to end up in hell when you die. But rather, if we don't address the internal issues in our lives, if we don't deal with the inside, then we're going to be in a state of decay. We're going to be rotting from the inside out. And Jesus is warning us, I think, that if we leave things unattended, if we don't deal with the issues on the inside and we're just checking boxes on the outside and doing just enough to please God, if that's the way we're living, then we're going to be in big trouble. Our lives are going to unravel. We'll be in a state of decay. I think that perhaps is a more realistic interpretation of what Jesus might have meant. Again, that's just my opinion. Other people would disagree with me, which is great. But I think that becomes more applicable in our present reality rather than necessarily it being something that's applicable in a reality after we die. Also in that passage, we have this graphic term, gouge your eye out or chop your hand off. You know, if one part of your body is causing you to sin, chop it off. I don't think that's one that we should take literally. There are unfortunate circumstances in history where people have interpreted that passage literally. I think in really awful ways. Personally, this is hyperbole. This is Jesus saying, "Hey, I'm serious here. Deal with these issues. This is really important. It's not lighthearted or this is serious and very sober." So in this passage, we have some, I think, troubling language or language that sort of jumps out to us and grabs our attention. I've given some explanations for that hopefully as we read through these antitheses, as you do that, as you look at the discussion questions, it'll give you a little bit of context to unpack them a little. As I said, I think hopefully it's going to draw us in more. It's that sort of sense of urgency, a sense of seriousness that should really grab our attention. Let's just sort of back away, as I said, a little bit, and just as we look at all these antitheses in general, I'm not going to dig down deep into all of them or really any of them. We'll reference some of them as we talk about this, but I really wanted to say, what is Jesus saying here? What is Jesus saying about these antitheses or in these antitheses? What is he, what points is he making? So the first one, I think, is that Jesus is saying we all struggle. By talking about murder, Jesus could be excluding a whole bunch of people who have never murdered anybody. And the reality is that most of us watching and listening right now have probably never murdered anybody. So we could say, well, that's not my problem. But Jesus, by going deeper, going into the inside, he makes it, in whether we like this or not, a very inclusive thing. He starts talking about anger, talking about sexually objectifying people, talks about resentment and not forgiving people. We are all guilty of that. We're all part of that. And so this is, I think Jesus is saying, even though many of our struggles are hidden, the reality is that we all struggle. Now, that could feel quite a condemning thing, but actually think about it this way. Maybe that's a very inclusive and liberating thing. It's like Jesus saying, we all struggle, let's face it honestly. And perhaps that's a starting point for us, even today, as we think about this, as we think about all our struggles. Some of these antitheses may highlight a particular struggle that we have. As I said, it's not an exhaustive list, though. So there'll be others that other things we struggle with that aren't necessarily in here. But I think we can take this as a liberating thing that God is here, God is present, and God knows we struggle. And we're all in this together. This is not about me being worse than anybody else. This is just being honest about where I am and how I struggle. So I think that's the first point we can say that Jesus is making here. And then I think we could say that our struggle, Jesus seems to be making the point that our struggle is related to two fundamental problems. And those are that we have a spiritual problem. In other words, our view of God is a problem. If we think of God as out there, if we think of God as other, if we think of God as someone who has to be pleased, if we think of God as someone who's checking up on us and watching us and making notes, then we'll probably end up trying to be law-abiding citizens and doing just enough to get by. Whereas if we think of God as present, as here, as being loving like a father and being in us and around us, then that loving presence can open us up to be both honest about what's going on the inside and also to be empowered to be transformed as we allow the divine presence to change us, to heal us, to work within us. And that's a very different view to the prevailing view in Jesus's time. So here, you know, Jesus is being pretty radical in terms of the notion of God and who God is. The second related problem for our struggle is we have a human problem. So we have a spiritual problem, how we view God, but we also have a human problem in how we view other people. There's a, I think personally, there's a theme to all these statements of Jesus, all these antitheses, which is the way in which we dehumanize other people. The way in which we view someone else. I think that's in the passage we read a little bit earlier about loving your enemies. That's, I think, you know, it's self-evident. We tend to dehumanize our enemies, and that sort of, for us, it gets us off the hook for hating people and for treating people badly. But in the first one of these, when Jesus talks about murder, let's just look at that, or the first part of it, is Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raca,' is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell." There we have the that word Gehenna again. I think what Jesus is getting at here is not it's wrong to be angry. There's plenty of other scriptures that indicate that anger can be a good thing. I think what Jesus is getting at here is unhealthy, violent anger. Where anger has got control of us, and anger has perhaps overwhelmed us, and we refuse to let it go, and we refuse to forgive people. It's a dehumanizing thing. And obviously, the ultimate dehumanization would be to take somebody's life, to take away their humanity, to murder them. But Jesus has seen this begins much sooner than that. This issue of unhealthy anger lies deep in the human experience, human consciousness, and deep in the human heart. And he's crying out, "Address it! Don't let it run wild. Don't let it get out of control." You know, it's interesting. He uses this word. Don't call somebody Raca. That's an Aramaic term. Interesting that they left Jesus's original language. He spoke Aramaic, not Greek. So they've left the original language in here. That means something like empty head. It's an offensive term, brainless, if you like. Again, very dehumanizing statement. Calling somebody a fool, so, you know, the other word uses is perhaps the equivalent. But it's interesting, I think, here how we use labels. We have names for people. Sometimes those are obviously horribly rude and insulting. But perhaps more subtly, we tend to label people. And we sort of have a running narrative in our minds internally. On the inside, we have a narrative about certain people, and boxes that we put them in, categories we put them in, all of which really is not treating them as a person. It's all dehumanizing. So I think we see that as I mentioned earlier in the next one, where Jesus said, "You have heard it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." The sexual objectification of people, which, you know, was a reality in Jesus' day. It's a reality in our day. It's subtle. It's not the word lust, you know, has lots of sort of negative connotations, and none of us would want to think that we're lustful people. The original word there is actually the same word used for desire. When Jesus says, "I've earnestly desired to eat this supper with you at the Last Supper," it's the same word. So it's not necessarily a word that we'd all be repulsed by. It's the subtlety of desire, where we want things and we objectify people, and it can creep up on us. This dehumanization of other people seems to be at the root of these problems that Jesus is talking about. So we have a problem with the way we see God. We have a problem with the way we see other people. The good news is that Jesus offers another way. Jesus offers a higher way. And he obviously, and this is a way that's higher than religion, if you like. It's a way that it's the kingdom of heaven. It's a way of life that will surpass the way of religion in Jesus's terms. And it comes from addressing these two issues of the way we see God. And we'll talk a little bit more about this next week when we talk about the Lord's Prayer. But this sense of God being intimately present to us now, God being love like a father, rather than a judge or a distant judge who's always checking up on us. So Jesus is sharing with us an alternative way of seeing and being with God. And also saying, you know, as we address these issues on the inside, as we look at ourselves, and realize that we are loved and that there's a way forward for us, no matter what our struggles are, that we then can grow in compassion for other people. We stop dehumanizing other people. We see other people as fellow strugglers, and we are able to let go of anger. We're able to let go of resentment. We are able to let go of dehumanizing and objectifying other people. And that's incredibly good news. And as I said earlier on, this isn't, it's not like, oh, everything's easy now. This is not an easy thing to do. It's like building your house on rock rather than on sand. It's entering through the narrow gate, as Jesus says at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. So this isn't necessarily easier than the way of religion or the way of the Pharisees. But there's something lighter about it, because it's not about just trying harder, trying to check more boxes, trying to please this God who's perfect and can't possibly be fully pleased with us. It's about partnering with God, being in communion with God, being in relationship with God, and growing from the inside out and being changed from the inside out. So that's, I think, good news. That's something to celebrate. So again, I want to encourage you to read that passage, several times, and look at the discussion questions. There's some good sort of breakdown of questions there that I think might help as you look at each of these antitheses, or if you want to home in, as I said, on just one or two of them. And the exercise, the prayer exercise this week, the stillness practice, I think also will really help us to get a little deeper into, okay, where is our struggle? What are the roots of our problems? And where do we need transformation? Where do we need to experience more of God's loving presence? One of the things we're doing, or encouraging people to do while we're having these virtual services together, is to still take communion. Obviously, if you could do that on your own. I don't think communion has to be bread or wine. It could be a cracker and water. In the early days of the church, when the first followers of Jesus started doing this, it was just having a meal together. So food and drink. But doing that in a way that remembers Jesus and remembers what Jesus stood for, what Jesus embodied. And I think if you're able to take communion right now, that would be a wonderful thing to do. Obviously, if you're in with other people, that's also a beautiful thing to do. Let's just remember again, with the current situation, the having best practice there in terms of hygiene and that kind of stuff. But let's remember this as we take communion, that really communion is a memory, a remembering that Jesus embodied this divine love, this way of life that we've been talking about. Jesus embodied it. And so when Jesus shares his body and his blood, he's sharing his essence. He's sharing who he is with us. And we get to, by eating and drinking it, metaphorically, of course, we get to participate in his body, participate in his blood, in his life, if you like. And so, really, I think what that's getting at is saying that Jesus came showing us a higher consciousness, a different way of thinking and being and living and doing. And we get to participate in that consciousness, the Christ consciousness, if you like. It's a journey. We're not there now. And just taking bread and wine isn't going to get us there. But it reminds us of this journey that we're on, that we're actually not only following Jesus, but we're actually embodying the very things that Jesus himself embodied. And that's a beautiful thing to do. So please feel free to take a moment to pause, to take communion, and then you can carry on with the rest of the service. Again, thank you so much for joining us. Be healthy, and let's embody the love of God in every aspect of our lives. Thank you.